hello, and welcome to Harp Column Podcast, taking you behind the stories in Harp Column from a practical harpist's perspective. My name is Christina Finch, and I will be your guide to all things harp. Episode 27 features harpist, teacher, and author of two articles in the September-October 2017 issue of Harp Column, titled Teacher's Pet and A Teacher's Perspective, Keela Walton. To get things started, I'll have Keela introduce herself.
Hello, Harp Column podcast listeners. I'm Keela Walton. I live in Buffalo, New York, where I teach harp and early childhood education at Buffalo Suzuki Strings. I'm also a freelancer. I've had the great privilege of subbing and playing second harp in the Rochester Philharmonic and in the Buffalo Philharmonic. I'm also honored to serve as the first vice president on the national board of the American Harp Society.
What inspired you to write the article for Harp Column?
Well, Allison Reese always has such great ideas for articles. So this one was originally her idea, but I loved it instantly. The goal was that no matter where you were as a student or a teacher, that you could find something that you were inspired to go and tackle.
Keela's article, Teacher's Pet, features a truly impressive list of contributing artists and reads something like a narrative for a successful harp life. I love it because it's so universally helpful. If you're a new teacher in need of resources, an amateur harpist looking to improve your technique, or a professional looking to fill in repertoire holes, this list has something to offer you. I asked Keela how she came to decide who to speak with and why.
Several things weeded down who the contributors were. I was at the American Harp Society Summer Institute in Minnesota, and I was talking with all of my harp friends and just asking them, you know, who would you want to hear from? So I sort of started with the list that way. I really wanted everybody to have time to think about and process the questions about what their favorite teaching pieces were, and I felt email would be the best way to approach it for everyone so they could really think about their response rather than a conversation where people might feel put on the spot. But I personally really found all of their insights to be very fascinating. Ella from Indiana at the Atlanta conference, she had done a workshop called Ella's Favorite, and it was all her favorite teaching pieces, and she actually already had a list. And so when I talked to her, I just said, I love all these pieces on this list. Do you want to talk more about any of them in particular?
You mentioned in your article that people sent you different kinds of lists and things like that. Did anybody else send you like an itemized list in that way?
Lynn Aspinus sent, almost a treatise. It was amazing. It was so thorough and so well thought out. And it was definitely in order of start with this piece and this builds this and that builds that. And so it was great. Joan Holland also sent a litany, a laundry list of pieces. It was great. It was wonderful to see that they had so many favorite things they love to teach and why. And then some other people sort of just sent one or two or three pieces. And that was fine too, because everybody had such interesting insights. It didn't matter how many pieces they listed. It was really what they were saying about them that I found the most fascinating.
Keela's accompanying article to Teacher's Pet, A Teacher's Perspective, gives us an opportunity to hear more of Keela's voice and opinions. One of the topics that she covers in her article that I found extremely fascinating and asked her to discuss further was the complete lack of any contemporary music, meaning music written within the last 25 years, on any of the lists of favorite teaching pieces provided by the contributors.
I actually went and looked it up, like, wow, when were these pieces written? The most contemporary pieces were The Birds in Winter, which I think was written in 89. And then perhaps some of the Bernard Andre stuff is relatively contemporary, but nothing really in the last 25 years. And it was something that I had noticed, but hadn't really thought too much about. But then Allison also mentioned it in an email back and forth when we were, you know, looking at the different drafts of the article. And so she saw this too. Okay, well, maybe it's worth addressing. It's much easier to fall in love with a piece that there are seven recordings of. And it's much easier to fall in love with a piece that you were taught or that you've taught a bunch of times. And so, yes, as a teacher, it can be daunting or challenging to try to teach something that you don't know, because it is more work. You do need to learn it in order to teach it, at least on some level. And so I think very often the motivation for teachers to step out of their comfort zone and teach something newer, or at least new to them, is because there is some other external motivation, like a competition or a student who wants to program this on a recital or whatever. There is some larger goal that's helping them. The other reason I thought this was an important thing to mention was that there are really interesting pieces by living composers. And I think the previous, so to speak, generation of harpists did a great job of getting these pieces into competition repertoire, onto lists, you know, whether it be the Royal School of Music lists for all those exams or the local competitions in their state. I've mentioned in the article that the competitions, especially on the national, international level, are doing a good job. And I think the main goal of my mentioning it was to try to help people at more local levels. So in their state competition list, to keep adding new works.
There's this moment in each podcast recording where I get to ask my guest if they would like to share something that they had to leave out of their article. The thing about writing for a magazine is that there's only so much room to accommodate an article, and word count limits are taken pretty seriously around here. When you feel really passionately about something, 1,500 words might not be enough to cover everything. That's where I come in. So let's find out what Keela left out.
It was very solo focused. Very few mentions of harp ensemble. And for me, harp ensemble is one of my great loves. I grew up in Texas, and harp ensemble is a big deal there. So I had written in the questions I sent all the teachers, I said, you know, feel free to include other things other than solos. It can be an orchestral excerpt. It can be harp ensemble. It can be whatever you want. And everybody gravitated towards solos. And it makes sense because the bulk of what most people teach is solo repertoire. I don't know how many harp teachers are out there with the opportunity of teaching in a group and having harp ensemble all the time, but there is a lot to be learned from harp ensemble repertoire, and I was kind of sad not to see more ensemble, you know, chamber music, harp ensemble, orchestra, anything that wasn't a solo that came up in people's favorites.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harp Column Music at harpcolumnmusic.com, where you can download PDFs of some of the best new arrangements and compositions for solo, ensemble, and chamber harp. We're thrilled to announce our new collaboration with Afghan Press, the newest publisher to join us at Harp Column Music. Afghan represents many of today's leading harp sheet music contributors, including Catherine Catter, whose solo harp piece Seagull is featured in the Harp Column Academy studio of Sunita Stanislow, and the music of Kim Robertson, one of our master teachers at Harp Column Academy. You're listening to Harp Column Podcast, episode number 27. You can read more harp news, feature stories, and subscribe to the print magazine at www.harpcolumn.com. Early on in the episode, Keela mentioned that she works for the Buffalo Suzuki Strings Program. I've always been fascinated with Suzuki teaching method, but I've never taken the leap to go to teacher training. But after hearing Keela talk about her time in the Suzuki program, I immediately started looking up an Every Child Can course schedule.
My Suzuki story began when I was 5 years old as a Suzuki piano student. And I loved my Suzuki piano teacher. I loved the whole experience. It was great. I still have a very close relationship with my mom, I think directly as a result of all of our practicing together when I was very little. And then I came to the harp later when I was 11. And there was Suzuki harp at the time, and my teacher dabbled in it. I'm not sure if she had done the training or not at this point. But the challenge there is that the Suzuki piano repertoire and the Suzuki harp, especially the first two books, they're almost identical. Lots and lots of the same pieces, because they're all these folk songs that are universal to any instrument. But if you have studied piano and harp, you know that your right hand is now backwards. And so in my ear, I knew how to do all of these pieces, but I didn't have the skills to play them. And so as a Suzuki harp student, it was actually really frustrating. And as a result, I sort of rebelled and wasn't very into Suzuki harp for a long time. But you can't escape who you are. And a good friend of mine, Jackie Venter, finally encouraged me to take the training. And I was fortunate enough to be living in Austin, where Delaine Leonard lives, and she's a Suzuki teacher trainer, and she was offering a training in Austin. And I thought, okay, get over yourself. You can do this. And Jackie's words that really encouraged me were, you're already a Suzuki teacher, because you already make your students listen to recordings all the time. And all teachers, I believe, really teach the way they were taught. You can take as many pedagogy classes as you want. You can watch master classes. You can do your best to learn other ways of teaching. But most people's default gut reaction to teaching is spitting back out how they were taught. When I took the Suzuki training, all of these things suddenly clicked in my brain. And I highly recommend it for anyone, especially if you are curious about how to help your beginners, how to set them up for success, especially if you want to teach very young children. I'm still in the process of taking training. I have not done all of the training for all the books. The way it works is you take training for each book. There are currently 5 Suzuki harp books. So I'm still in the process of doing the training. I've just found it to be an incredible community of very supportive people. The first Suzuki conference I ever attended was 2 summers ago. And I was very nervous because I was in Minneapolis, and I didn't know a lot of those harpists in Minneapolis very well at the time. So I walk into the first harp masterclass, and there's Nicole Brady, who we've only ever emailed before about the Harp Family Tree article, the Big Happy Family article. And she's like, I loved your article. It was so great. I'm so glad you're here. I was really excited when I saw your name on the list of people attending. And this is before she's about to sit down and do a masterclass. And she's taking time to come over and talk to me. It was just mind-blowing. Everybody was so nice. And even though a lot of them had known each other their whole lives, had grown up as Suzuki harp kids all together in Utah, they were just so welcoming and so open. I remember thinking as I went back up to my room at the end of the day, man, why am I surprised that everybody was so kind and so nice? Because they've been raised in this method, which is a philosophy that is more about your character and who you are as a person than about the music. And it's one of the things I love about Suzuki. It's about helping your students become noble, compassionate, determined, disciplined people. Suzuki said character first, ability second. And I was like, well, yeah, of course, everybody's great and wonderful. They've been raised to be this way. So I feel like it's a really wonderful philosophy and teaching methodology and community.
Teaching music is not my main purpose. I want to make good citizens. If children hear fine music from the day of their birth and learn to play it, they develop sensitivity, discipline, and endurance. They get a beautiful heart. Shinichi Suzuki. There's one more piece of the Keela Walton puzzle that I wanted to investigate further after reading her bio. All the way at the bottom, after all the juicy details about Keela's education, experience, and expertise, there's a sentence that caught my eye. Quote, after realizing how much her yoga practice enhanced her harp life, Keela became certified in Dharma Yoga at the 300-hour level. End quote. 300 hours is equivalent to 12.5 days, or 18,000 minutes. Most people in my generation only put that kind of time into video games.
I had several adult students, and I wanted to understand where they were coming from. And this idea came into my head that, okay, I should just become a beginner again at something. I should be totally new at something, and then I'll have a better understanding of what's going on with my students. So I had always wanted to try yoga, and I thought it would be a great one because there's all this terminology that's in Sanskrit, right? Like music has all this terminology that's in Italian that people don't know. It'll be just a whole new thing that I don't know anything about. So I went just to the yoga studio that was in my neighborhood and fell in love with the place. The teacher there, the very first class, he put a little card on everyone's mat, and it was a Leonard Cohen quote, "Ring the bells that still can ring, forget your perfect offering, there is a crack in everything, and that is how the light gets in." At the time, I was working on audition repertoire and feeling like such a failure because these excerpts were really just taking me to town. in the audition, you have such short window of time to get it exactly right. And I was very caught up in the perfectionist paralyzation of it all. and here I was in this yoga class, and I got this quote about forget being perfect. You're going to learn something from this. The light's going to get in no matter what happens. It was like this huge burden had been lifted off of me. And so I was like, okay, well, maybe there is definitely something to this whole yoga thing. And the theme of the class was that there's no such thing as a perfect asana. So asana is your position, your seat in yoga. And you never will perfect an asana. And this was mind-blowing to me because it's like, that's what it's like at the harp. I'm never going to perfect anything at the harp. And it was very freeing. It was so liberating. It's like, so you just go deeper and you just keep getting better and better. And it's okay that it's not perfect, because really, is anything ever perfect? And I know I'm kind of going crazy here about this, but it was just so helpful. And it was so nice to be in a place where my brain could just chill out. And all I had to do was think about breathing. And it didn't matter if I was touching my toes or not. I found there were so many parallels that I could take into my heart practice. And then I was starting to share these things with my students because they were so helpful to me. The teachers there were so supportive. Again, I found a nice community. So I decided, yeah, why not? I'll take the training. And the goal of my taking the training was never to like open my own yoga studio or become a big yoga guru. It was more about just understanding what was going on in a yoga practice. Dharma yoga is taught through the lens of Buddhism, which I found to be a nice added spiritual element to it. So it wasn't about bending yourself into a pretzel. It wasn't about getting to the next level and knowing the next sequence of poses. It was never about any of that. It was always about just breathing, feeling good, training your mind. I found it really helped my focus when I was practicing and my mind to wander less, the whole meditative aspect of it. Not every yoga studio is like that. It's like harp techniques and methods. You can find the one that you like, that fits you and your lifestyle and how your mind works. So if you need something much more physical to get your brain to be quiet, then go do that. And if you need something more meditative to help with your focus and stress and all of that, then go find that. And there's a type of yoga for everyone, just like there's a harp technique or method or book or etude or whatever for everyone.
To bring us back to the two articles that Keila wrote for the September-October 2017 issue of Harp Column, I asked if she could add one of her own favorite pieces to the list, what it would be.
I loved a lot of the things on the list. There were a few things on that list that were new to me that I immediately went out and ordered because, like, okay, I gotta go check this out. I would say this missing from the list for me would be the Salzedo Suite of Eight Dances. If I had to take one set of music to a desert island with, you know, the harp and me, it would be that, which I guess is cheating because it's eight pieces rather than one. But anyway, especially the seguidilla, the tango, the rumba, those are so much fun to play. And when I'm teaching them, I can hear Miss Barrington, who taught me the eight dances, I can hear her voice coming through me as I teach. And they're so helpful for students. I mean, if you have a student that has trouble with rhythm or counting or anything like that, and then just getting the really nice, clean, fast technique. I mean, there's a lot of wonderful technical things in there. Yeah, I would have to say the Suite of Eight Dances is what's missing from the list for me.
My desert island piece? The Grangini Rhapsody. And here's where we come to the proverbial fork in the road between the two schools of thought in our community. For all the Salzedo on Keila's list, mine is filled with Grangini and Tournier. I never even learned the Suite of Eight Dances until after I left college, and have yet to even consider tackling the number one most significant work according to this article, The Theme and Variations in an Ancient Style by Salzedo. But the great part about this list is that it opened my eyes to the fact that there is basically an entire world of repertoire that I have yet to explore because of built-in and taught biases that come naturally in our community. The great thing, though, for those of us just entering the world of teaching, and for those to come, things are opening up and changing.
You know, I think that's one of the great things about harpists, you know, that are sort of coming into the era of teaching now, is that they have so much access to so many teachers that they don't have to just follow one school. And I think when I talk to younger harpists, they really see how the schools aren't that different. It's not even really about technique being that different. It's just that there's sort of a set of repertoire that these different schools use. And it's all beautiful repertoire. It's all great music. So I think that's one of the great things that's happening in the harp world these days.
That's it for our 27th episode. Many thanks to Keela Walton for joining us today. Music for today's episode comes from the new CD, Vignette, featuring Maeve Gilchrist on harp and Victor Krauss on bass. Reviewed in the September-October 2017 issue of Harp Column by Allison Young, and available on iTunes and Amazon Music. To learn more about Harp Column, please visit www.harpcolumn.com and subscribe today to gain access to current and past issues, as well as a lot of great web content. My name is Dr. Christina Finch, and we at Harp Column hope that you have a spectacular week.